Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, I had the pleasure to sit down with an amazing woman named Daniela Contreras. She is a spokesperson for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and she actually participated in Logic's one-day performance at the VMAs with a whole bunch of other people who were invited to... the song and the video are about family separation and the racism and neo-Nazism in this country. And she and a bunch of other people were invited to go on stage and sort of as a visual representation of what's happening with these kind of policies. And she's fascinating. And we talked about her work with domestic workers and undocumented immigrants and how they're more vulnerable to some abuses than others. And it was wonderful. She's very smart. She herself is a dreamer and was talking about her own status. And honestly, it is such a powerful interview. You do not want to miss it. It is so good. Also, before we get to that though, we would like to talk a little bit about Manafort and Cohen and who's going to jail and why. And spoiler alert, it's not Hillary Clinton.
Oh my God.
Michael Cohen.
Her Chardonnay collection must be huge at this point.
Oh my God, I want to buy her $1,000 bottle of Chardonnay and send it to her and be like, "Girl,
I'm so sorry. We could have had taco trucks in every corner and a president we had never seen."
Come on. We're also going to talk a little bit about Me Too and Keith Ellison and Asia Argento. That's a very difficult needle to thread. Arsha and I were actually just talking about how difficult these kind of stories are to talk about, so we're going to kind of work through it together. And talk about why they feel more difficult and what they mean. We're also going to talk about Molly Tibbetts and basically the right and the president using a young woman's death to further political discourse. So we're going to just jump right in.
Okay, Devin, what are the latest crimes that have been committed?
I mean, the fact that we live in a world where that's the opening salvo to our show really says a lot. Well, Manafort was convicted on 8 out of 18 counts by the jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. He was convicted on bank fraud, tax fraud, and filing false reports about his foreign contacts. And it looks like most of the charges that they didn't convict on and the jury was hung on, which means the judge declared a mistrial in those 10 counts. Looked like they had to do a lot with the Rick Gates stuff. And I'm not necessarily believing Rick Gates, although that's just me, non-lawyer, what I've gathered from watching lawyers on TV. And that those 10 charges, since it's a mistrial, the prosecutors can choose to retry those 10 charges, though there's no signal as to whether they will or not.
He has enough time with these 8. And also, I think I was listening to other people talk about this, people who are actually lawyers, and they were just like, Mueller has shown what he wanted to show with the Manafort trial is that he can bring a case, he can get the convictions. And at this point, there's either I don't know. There's two things going on here. Either Mueller is just this evil, not evil, but genius who's just waiting and set a trap for Trump to pardon this guy, or he's just he's waiting for Manafort to flip. And if Manafort doesn't flip, he's fine because he still has all the information Rick Gates is going to give him, other people are going to give him. I think he knows what he's doing. And I think that's what's important.
It is always both.
Yeah. And I think. Yeah, I think it's important to remember that Mueller probably knows a lot more than we do, and he probably knows a lot more than Manafort does, which is just really interesting.
Well, there was that one moment in Manafort's case where Rick Gates was testifying, and the defense lawyer asked him, "Have you been approached by the Mueller investigation in any other capacity?" And the prosecutors made an objection to it, and it's a sealed objection. And basically saying he can't answer that. So it's obvious that Rick Gates is more involved than just this Manafort case. And also, let's not forget that Manafort has another trial in D.C. coming up. So this isn't even over for him. But I think you're right. I think it's both that Mueller, I don't know about evil, but definitely cunning genius.
Yeah.
He's kind of set this trap, but then also is kind of seeing if Manafort will then be like, oh, shit, and then flip. So either way, justice wins, Trump loses.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm so optimistic and hopeful, but.
Yeah.
You know.
And literally at the same exact moment, these legal reporters are in the court watching Manafort's, like, the jurors bring down the verdict, right? And at the same exact moment, like 2 minutes mm-hmm. earlier, Michael Cohen is in New York pleading guilty to a lot of things. So not only does he plead guilty to multiple counts of tax evasion and a single count of bank fraud, this is the Southern District of New York. He also admits that as President Trump's former lawyer, he basically said that Trump directed him to arrange payments to two women during the 2016 campaign to keep them from speaking publicly about affairs they said they had with Trump. So this is Stephanie Clifford, aka Stormy Daniels, and Karen McDougal. And that's amazing. And literally just this morning, before we started to record, Pecker, the guy who runs the National Enquirer, has been granted immunity in the Michael Cohen case. Ah. Why does Pecker need immunity? Maybe because, like, basically they bought the Karen McDougal story, right, the National Enquirer, and then they quashed it. That's part of this whole paying off the people Trump has had affairs with story. That's part of, I think, Karen McDougal's civil suit, right? And so the reason I find this Michael Cohen, like, story interesting, like, obviously because he was the president's longtime lawyer and quote-unquote fixer and has just been, like, pleaded guilty to committing crimes. Also, he has directly implicated the president. Like, this guy a couple months ago was saying, I take a bullet for Donald Trump. And today he's saying, hey, yeah, Donald Trump told me to commit crimes. I did the crimes.
I think that's really an important point, is that we've gone from, I'll take a bullet for this guy, to Donald Trump was the one who instructed me to do this. And people are saying, like, oh, I don't know if that necessarily implicates the president, or if that, you know, means there's legal exposure for the president. And I'm just like, yeah, maybe, how do I put this? He's fucked.
Yeah.
Either way. I mean, it's basically what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, because you can say, and you can be one of those annoying reporters who's just like, oh, people in West Virginia don't care about Michael Cohen or Paul Manafort. It doesn't fucking matter, because independents across the country might. Democrats across the country might. This might encourage them to vote more. So, like, there is obviously, like, everyone is saying, oh, even though Michael Cohen implicated Trump, Trump cannot be indicted while he's in the White House. And yes, that is the Department of Justice guidelines, that you can't indict a sitting president, but you could indict a president who leaves office. You could impeach a president for high crimes and misdemeanors. And this
also, let's not forget, it was also a DOJ policy to not fuck around in presidential elections with 10 days to go. So, like, policy is a little bit, you know, loosey-goosey here.
There are multiple interpretations to it. And also, fuck James Comey.
Also, fuck James Cook. Just so we haven't said it in a while, I feel like I needed to get that off my chest.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out, so Trump tweeted about these two things, because of course he did, because he can't help himself. But the one that I really want to talk about is about Paul Manafort, because I'm just going to read it, and I hate reading Trump tweets, but I think this one's really important for context. He said, quote, I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice, in quotes, took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him, and unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to, quote, break, make up stories in order to get a, quote, deal. Such respect for a brave man. So I'm not a huge fan of, like, mobster shows and mobster movies, and never been really my thing, but holy fucking shit, it sounds like this guy came out of central casting for a old, like, mob family guy. I mean, what the fuck? No, like, what the actual fuck? Like, refuse to break to get what? I mean, it's ridiculous. And comparing Paul Manafort to Michael Cohen and saying, oh, my, you know, Cohen broke and Manafort didn't. I mean, it's basically just screaming, like, you did me solid, dude. I'm going to get you back. I mean, how does it not read like that to everyone?
It's basically him signaling a pardon, in my opinion. Like, we could be wrong. But, like, the tweet right after was, like, a large number of counts, 10, could not even be decided in the Paul Manafort case. Witch hunt. it's not that they weren't decided. It was a hung jury. He wasn't acquitted of those 10 counts. So that's why the prosecutors can still try to try him again, because he wasn't acquitted. There's no double jeopardy here, right? So I think that's what's interesting here, is that like the president, and also there a bunch of conservative publications are like, oh, but he only got like 8 out of 10. He's not a real criminal. Yes, he is. He definitely is.
Yes, 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 he is. 8 out of 10, or I'm sorry, 8 out of 18.
8 out of 18, yeah.
Is still a fucking criminal.
It is.
So,
and his Michael Cohen tweet was bananas too, because he basically said, I'm reading it right now, Michael Cohen plead guilty, grammar is off. Michael Cohen plead guilty to 2 counts of campaign finance violations that are not a crime. President Obama had a big campaign finance violation and it was easily settled. What? It was definitely a crime. And so like he had this interview with this Fox News host and it was just gibberish. But basically he's saying that, you know, paying off Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal wasn't a crime, but it was, because they didn't disclose it properly. And the Obama thing he's referring to is that basically near the end of the Obama campaign, you have to report a lot of the money you're getting very quickly. And they basically not forgot, but didn't do it as fast as they should have. And so they paid a fine of $375,000. But it's not because they were like paying off mistresses. They weren't hiding money.
Can you even fucking imagine?
Yeah.
If that was the Obama scandal. I mean, I know we can go into this all day, every day, but can you fucking imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So I also just want to say really quickly before we move on, poor Duncan Hunter, who is a congressman who was also indicted yesterday for campaign fraud.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not going to get his day in the sun in terms of the news cycle, because it's been sucked up by Manafort and Cohen. But Duncan Hunter was also indicted. That would make 2 Trump-supporting congresspeople. Two of the first congressmen to support Donald Trump indicted on federal charges.
You know who the third one was? Jeff Sessions.
Who? Jeff Sessions. Ooh. Oh.
If 2018 is a tragedy written by the reanimated ghost of Shakespeare, like, it would only make sense that Jeff Sessions is the next person who is like indicted or gets in trouble. And I think it'd be awesome. But
that's fucking amazing. All right, Farsha. So let's talk a little bit about Keith Ellison and this woman named Asia Argento and the Me Too movement. So can you kind of tell us what's going on here?
Yeah. So Keith Ellison, he's a Democratic congressman from Minnesota. He's the co-chair of the DNC. He's running for attorney general there as well. Basically, a couple of weeks ago, the son of Keith Ellison's ex-girlfriend, Karen Moynihan, he wrote a lengthy Facebook post saying that he saw a video of Ellison grabbing his mom and like swearing at her in a bedroom. And another woman in 2006, Amy Louise Alexander, spoke out against Ellison as well, saying that Ellison verbally abused her while they were in a relationship, and also that he grabbed and pushed her. And Karen Moynihan like first spoke out on TV about this on CNN, and basically she said like this is a true story. She spoke with like conviction, and Ellison has denied it. He's basically like, this video can't exist because I don't behave that way. And you know, I've been averse to talking about this for so long, because even though I believe both these women, I really do, because the way that they talk about their story, it's just, it's so evident that they're telling the truth. But at the same time, it's a different feeling than the Al Franken feeling. Do you know what I mean? Like, right after the Al Franken, that first photo came out of him basically like doing something horrible to a woman, it was just like, no, this guy is a creep. And then 8 more stories came out about like other women who've been groped by Al Franken. You're just like, yeah, I knew it from that first photo, right? This is like, I know this is bad, but at the same time, I'm like, it's so confusing. I don't know where I stand. And I think that's just, it's really difficult. But I do think like what should go forward is similar as what was supposed to go forward in the Al Franken thing, where like there was supposed to be a proper ethics investigation. And then we decided if Ellison was going to lose his job, right? So like the reason Franken didn't have an ethics investigation was because there was a lot of evidence. There was like a lot of stories.
Necessary.
They were all corroborated. And then his Democratic senators, the women in the Democratic Senate, were just like, no, you got to go. right? And so if there are like two more cases that come out against Ellison, I'm not saying like I don't believe these two already. It's just this is how it's like going to work, right? This is how you're going to like get the ball rolling. So if you like currently like believe these two stories, I understand how you're feeling because I believe them too, but I don't know how Ellison leaves without an ethics investigation or more accusers, right? Or more evidence.
I'm so, you know, we haven't talked about this much because it there's something weird about it.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't believe these women. It's not that I even feel that there needs to be more accusers to like show a pattern. I mean, you know, abusing one woman is plenty.
Exactly.
In my book. I think initially I was wary of it. Like when the story first came out, because it was his ex-girlfriend's son who said something. And I was a little wary of that. But then once she said that it was true, then it was like, okay, I think Ellison needs to leave. And I think that an ethics investigation is definitely procedure, but I do think that he needs to just get the fuck out. Yeah. And I think what I want him to do, which I realize that this is a fucking pipe dream, but I want him to just bow out and be like, you know what? I'm not going to make you do this. I'm not going to make you do an ethics investigation or kick me out. I'm just going to leave because I know that it's right. But like, men are fucking canceled for a reason, and it's because they've never fucking done that.
Yeah, I just want to be clear. Like, I don't think there should be more accusers in order to believe Ellison. Right. I believe these women. It's just this is like the pattern that has been happened in Washington is that like the first couple come out and people don't believe these women. And then a couple more come out or more corroboration comes out. And then finally everyone's like, oh, yeah, OK, you got to go. Like because the Conyers story, it took a couple weeks. Right. The Franken story took a couple weeks. The Blake Farenthold story, people still don't really like believe that. What he did, even though he used money to pay them off, right? It took a while. So I just think that's the issue here is that like the way that Washington works or the way that this kind of story works is that like people are going to continue to believe Ellison and stand by Ellison because basically in the first couple of days of the Franken story, no senator wanted to talk about Franken. They weren't defending him, but they
didn't want to talk about
him. They weren't talking about him either. Same thing's happening right now with the Ellison story. Like no one's talking about him. Especially people who you would argue are more in his political camp because he's a little bit further to the left than a couple of congressmen, right? And so I find that interesting. And it's just really depressing that yet another man has let me down.
Well, and I also, on sort of this vein, want to talk about this woman, Asia Argento, who is, I believe, a director. And she has been a very public face of the Me Too movement, along with Rose McGowan. She told her story about being raped by Harvey Weinstein when she was in her 20s. And she really was part of the kickoff movement the kickoff portion of the Me Too movement. And there were reports that she had, and she actually paid a young man whom she had abused, and she paid him off. And people are saying, does this mean that it's the end of the Me Too movement? And here's what I want to say about that. No. The Me Too movement is not tied to one person or one group of people. And I think that this is really important, especially talking to Daniela in the interview about, you know, domestic workers and farm workers. And Me Too is so much more than just powerful white women in Hollywood. And just because one person did something wrong, like someone like Asia Argento, does not invalidate the whole movement because it's not just about one person. Me Too is about more than just, you know, some people coming out against Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
It's about a culture of toxic masculinity and a culture that has allowed women of all races and classes and ages to be victimized by men.
Exactly. And I totally agree with that, that it's obviously the Me Too movement is not over because it wasn't about Asia Argento. Like even though she was one of the first accusers of Harvey Weinstein, like it wasn't about her. It was about the fact that Me Too, literally every woman had an experience of this, severe or not severe or whatever, that they've all had an experience about this. And that's what's so, you know, that's what's so important about the Me Too movement is that we can all get together and talk about that. And so there are people who were, excuse me, there are people who are like afraid of the Me Too movement and being like, oh, has Me Too gone too far? And now they're just like, justice for Jimmy Bennett, the actor that Argento abused. And I'm just like, you're acting in bad faith. We can all see you. We've seen the past tweets. We've seen the current tweets. You're acting in bad faith. And
well, men are terrified of this, yeah, right? Because they're saying, oh, now we can't even talk to women in the workplace, blah, blah, blah. And so they're looking for reasons to invalidate it and shut it down. And, you know, when stories like this one about Asia Argento comes out, like it's an easy in, right? Oh, Me Too is over. Like this is over. This person is a bad actor. And so this whole movement was started in bad faith and la, 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 I can't hear you. That's what this is.
Yeah.
And I'm not defending Asia Argento at all.
Exactly.
I am just saying that this isn't fucking about her. And what she does and what she did and what she continues to do has, I'm not going to say no effect on the Me Too movement, but it has nothing to do with the core movement.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it sucks that she, and she's also an abuser, you know, but, and it breaks my heart that she's also an abuser. But at the same time, that doesn't mean she wasn't abused. That doesn't mean other women aren't suffering abuses. That doesn't mean Me Too is over. Just because a whole bunch of white men want it to be over doesn't mean that it's
exactly
over, no matter what stories come out.
Exactly. I think that's basically what how I feel about both these two stories, is that I think multiple things can be true at once. I think it can be true that Keith Ellison was a horrible boyfriend and abused two women, and I also think it can be true that Washington is going to need a lot more momentum to kick the guy out, even though I think he should be kicked out immediately, right, which I find frustrating. Asia Argento was abused by Harvey Weinstein, and she abused Jimmy Bennett, and Me Too is not over. Those are the multiple things that are true.
Right. They're all true at the same time. Okay, Varsha, so the last thing I want to talk about is the murder of Molly Tibbetts. So Molly Tibbetts was a 20-year-old college student in Iowa who was murdered. And the Trump administration and Fox News has jumped on this murder. Can you tell us why?
Basically, they accused Christian Rivera of providing false identification when he applied for a job at this farm that he worked at. Which is owned by a Republican, yeah. And also, it just came out this morning that the lawyer of Christian Rivera says he has legal status. So just to putting that out there, just in case people want to continue to assume he was an undocumented immigrant. But because he's an undocumented immigrant, or because they assumed he was, Tucker Carlson and all these people on the alt-right and the far-right have just gone bananas and saying, this is what we mean when we're saying that, like, you know, undocumented immigrants bring crime into the country. This is why we shouldn't be allowing them in. This is why we're in danger. This is why we need a wall. But they're also, what they're doing in saying all of this is that they're politicizing her death in a way that's like unacceptable, right? It's unacceptable because they're basically saying she is this like sacred white woman who like got hurt by like a scary brown person. And people should remember this kind of same narrative from Jim Crow, except it was against black men. And it's still, you know, we still have that narrative against black men today. It's like people are, and trans people, right? So people today, the way they make an argument against something that they're afraid of is that they say, oh no, this will hurt like the women, or this will hurt the vulnerable in our society. Think of the children, but specifically think of like white women and white children. But
yeah, I think you mentioned like with like the trans community, yeah, a lot of those arguments, like the bath, quote unquote bathroom arguments, are like, well, there, you want men in the women's rooms? And it's like, no, we want women in the women's rooms, you shithead. But yeah, it's definitely using this like this white femininity as a weapon.
Yeah. And no one's like defending her murder here, obviously. Like Simone Sanders had a great tweet about this, a great thread about this. Basically, she said Molly Tibbetts was murdered because she told a man to leave her alone while she was jogging. Quote, her murderer happens to be undocumented, and that's not correct anymore. But this isn't about border security. This is about toxic masculinity, exactly what we were talking about before. So for some reason, Republicans or, you know, people who are afraid of undocumented immigrants only care about women being murdered when it's conducted by immigrants. They don't care about it when it happens every goddamn day with guns and white men. They don't care about it when it happens when, you know, other types of abuse happen. They don't care about it on other days. They only care about it when they can use it for their political purposes. And that's what's disgusting about it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, they're politicizing this death, even though Molly Tibbetts' family does not want it politicized. But when there's a mass shooting or, you know, domestic violence or white male terrorists, it's like, we cannot politicize the gun issue. People are dead. Like, we couldn't possibly talk about this. We cannot possibly make changes or inroads on any of this. And so it's the blatant hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jessica Valenti had a great tweet and it just was perfect. And Simone Sanders also, she said it, like, Molly Tibbetts was murdered because a man wouldn't leave her alone while she was jogging. But Jessica Valenti said, quote, "The deadliest demographic for American women isn't immigrants. It's husbands and boyfriends. But the truth about who kills women in this country isn't politically useful for the White House."
Exactly. And the thing is, the reason she was responding, she tweeted this in response to a video that the White House released about, like, all these parents talking about how horrible it is that, you know, undocumented immigrants, like, kill their children or their relatives. And they had this horrible, like, tweet. It said, you know, the White House said, "For 34 days, investigators searched for 20-year-old Molly Tibbetts. Yesterday, an illegal alien now charged with first-degree murder led the police to the cornfield where her body was found." So, like, and then they said, they used this language, "The Tibbetts family has been permanently separated. They're not alone."
Yes.
How disgusting is that?
I had to read that twice before I was like, there's no fucking way that they're actually using the language, "This family was permanently separated." But they did.
They did. And they know what they're doing. Like, the guy who's running this account knows exactly what the fuck he's doing. Dan Scavino, I think, right? Yeah, Dan Scavino knows exactly what he's doing. He's using this language because at this point, Trump probably loves the family separation policy, right?
And people are so outraged, you know, even people in his base were outraged by the family separation. Oh, this is another type of family separation.
And this is about me. This affects me.
Immigrants are creating family separation too. And so kind of, you know, putting it back on this group. And again, this guy, no one is defending this guy. No one thinks murder is a good idea. No one thinks that murdering a woman is acceptable. But to say that it's somehow related to his immigration status is bullshit.
Yeah. There are studies after studies that show that immigrant crime is not high. And there was a great article by Herman Lopez in Vox that basically details all these studies. And a native there's a study of, like, crime and prevalence of crime, and, like, when it comes to crime, like, crime drops when you have more immigrants in your community. It doesn't go higher. Right. It's not statistically significant to say that immigrants commit more crime. That's just not true. And so there is a selection bias effect where they're just saying, oh, because this one immigrant committed a crime, that must mean all these immigrants commit a crime. Remember the travel ban. Remember everything else we've talked about in the way that Donald Trump stereotypes. He takes one true thing that happened. Yes, this person is an immigrant, but he had legal status, and say, oh yeah, all immigrants are dangerous and they're rapists and they're bringing drugs. And it's
well, and Simone Sanders had a in this thread that she did. I want to read this one tweet because it so connects so beautifully to what you're saying, Varsha. She said, quote, "Her murderer actually might not even be undocumented. Regardless, it is problematic for people to characterize an entire community based on the actions of one person. The majority of mass shootings in America are carried out by white men. So we're going to round them all up, right?"
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, this isn't about immigration. This is about toxic masculinity. And the administration using Molly Tibbetts as some sort of, I don't know, lightning rod is absolutely just disgusting. Our guest today is Daniela Contreras. She is a leading organizer in New York City, working with the National Domestic Workers Alliance to educate nannies, house cleaners, and home care workers about their rights in the workplace. She is the daughter of a domestic worker and experienced firsthand the challenges of working in the sector. As an immigrant, dreamer, and single mother of a 7-year-old, Daniela is passionate about social justice and making sure that all people have the working conditions to live and thrive. She has been a national spokesperson for the Me Too movement, speaking publicly at events hosted by Time's Up about the need for sexual harassment protection in low-wage sectors. When she is not organizing, Daniela enjoys creative writing, photography, and spending time with her daughter. Thank you, Daniela, so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to jump right in. You recently participated in Logic's performance at the VMAs of his song One Day, which is the song and the video are about family separation and racism in this country. Why did you choose to participate?
Because I knew that, you know, MTV had watched pretty much, if I'm not mistaken, it's a global, like, people get to see it all over the world. And I wanted this message. I wanted people to know that, yeah, we might be only in the United States, but this situation is happening, I think, everywhere. Parents, kids are being separated. And I guess they need to know what's reality. I guess young people need to know what's happening. Yeah.
Has there been a powerful reaction to that performance and your participation in that performance?
Yes. I've been after the show, I've been seeing what people are posting on their Logic's performance. And a lot of young people have something to say. And I'm like, that's good. That's good. They want to know. And I understand some of them don't agree at all. And I made a comment to one young kid. He said that illegals were not, shouldn't be together, I think he said.
Jesus.
And I'm like, well, he's a 16-year-old. And I said, look, I do respect your point of view, and I think we do all have different points of view. If that's what you think, well, I'm glad you, well, I'm not glad. But it's kind of weird. It's hard to see what people think sometimes. And I don't know.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially because, you know, that's not exactly a point of view so much as just saying that some people aren't worth as much as others, which is terrible. But do you see the power of celebrity in this kind of discussion? So Logic using his platform to bring attention to this, is that something that's helpful and something that you think is useful in terms of these type of issues?
Well, like going back to those postings that I've been reading, many fans claim that all Logic wants to do is just, it's a publicity stunt. And I don't think so. He's very, like, I've been following him. I've been doing my own personal research. And I found out that he is involved in certain things, in political things. He has his personal points of view, opinion. And that's great. And I'm glad he reached out to us. If I'm not mistaken, I think his team reached out to us. And they said, we want to work together. Would you be interested in being part of my performance and bringing this topic, since you guys are leading the campaign, the Families Belong Together? And yeah, he invited us and other two groups, the United We Dream, which is all about dreamers, and Make the Real, which is a local group here in New York.
So as a dreamer yourself and someone who is involved in this activism and these organizations, what are the most important policies or what are the most important issues that we need to focus on moving forward?
I would say all of them.
Yeah, definitely.
A personal thing, I feel like they all affect me at some point. The family separation, given that I am a mother, and even this morning, I'm going to get emotional. I had to explain my daughter what, because I made a comment before, and I guess she never heard it over the weekend, and I said that she heard me say that at any time I could be separated from my daughter. And this morning she's like, Mommy, why did you say that? Like, can you tell me why? Like, are we going to get separated? And I had to explain to her that because of the whole chaos that's happening with DACA, that there is a chance that we might have to be separated. So she started crying. And it's reality. Recently, remember when he terminated, he had, I don't know how to say it, but when on September when they announced that DACA had ended, and the last people who were able to renew where it was until March 5th. Just I was pretty much left out because for me, I was supposed to renew on March 9th, and I was pretty much left for 4 days. So for months, I was not, honestly, I went through some siege of chaos. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't work, because of DACA, I've been able to get not one, but two or three jobs. I love to work. I'm a single mom, so I have to support my daughter. And I was like, okay, so if once this expires, so what's going to happen to me? How am I supposed to support my daughter? And I'm a human citizen. And the only thing, I'm not harming anybody. I'm not causing any trouble. All I'm doing is I am helping people. And that's why I joined this organization, because I like what they were doing. I am committed to their message, to what they're doing for the community, for domestic workers.
So in telling your daughter, you know, what's going on and explaining your activism work and telling your story, how is that related to the Me Too movement? And you know, is there power in telling that story in, mm-hmm. in all of your stories in terms of creating better and safer environments for domestic workers and women in these spaces where sexual harassment is rampant?
Yes. I, as you mentioned it, I'm one of the spokespersons for the Time's Up and Me Too movement for domestic workers. And it took me, going back to my story, it took me 16 years for me to come forward and bring and talk about this topic. And now knowing that, you know, I had an organization that will be behind supporting me, speaking the language, knowing about that, my status, it's okay so far. But in my work as an organizer, I encounter so many house cleaners, nannies who've spoken. Not completely. I've been to events where I share my story, and after the meetings, usually they come to me and they're like, "Can I talk to you?" Or the only thing they say is like, "It happened to me too," and I'm like, "When did this happen? Like many years ago." Some of them it has happened, and some of them are recent, and we're trying to protect them, but it's hard. Fear of or being because usually employers they're fear of retaliation. What their employers say, well, if you say something, I will make sure you get supported, or I know where you live, or you are not longer going to have your job. And why do women have to go through this? As Oprah said it on her speech on the Golden Globes, like, why do a woman have to choose between bringing a paycheck or, you know, your safety? It shouldn't be that way. And the sad part is that this, with domestic workers, job, what the jobs are, it's secluded. Like, no one... You can't complain to anybody but your employer, but that employer is the one that's harassing you. So where do you go? And that's why we're trying to reach out. Like, we want domestic workers to know that, yes, you can come to us. There's no HR at your job, but you can come to us.
Is part of the fear of these women, of these domestic workers, wrapped up in their immigration status? And does that play into how they handle sexual harassment and sexual mm-hmm. abuse in their workplace, which is obviously very intimate, you know, very isolated?
It does. And actually, it's sometimes just the assumption employers make that the workers are undocumented, maybe because they don't speak the language, maybe because they're just domestic workers. I've met a lot of nannies and house cleaners who are U.S. citizens, and probably they don't speak the language, but they're U.S. citizens. So it's just they think they can, I don't know.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of American citizens who work in domestic spaces, and I think that we don't think of that necessarily. I mean, I even just made an assumption in that question. So, you know, the Me Too movement was sort of kicked off by powerful female celebrities in Hollywood sort of coming out against Harvey Weinstein and making accusations against this large, powerful man. Has the Me Too movement also served these immigrant communities or these domestic worker communities as well? So in addition to the celebrity, the high powered women who are, you know, coming forward with their stories, is Me Too also working for the communities that you represent?
We actually have been working very close with Hollywood people, Hollywood actresses. Recently, we were at the Capitol with Jane Fonda, and it was a great experience having my domestic workers with Hollywood, who is such an amazing Hollywood actress, and going to the government pretty much and requesting them, we need domestic workers and farm workers to be protected from sexual harassment. And we've given a grant from Time Fox to the National Domestic Workers Alliance so that we can, especially in New York, I'm going to have to ask Natalia to give you more details about it. But we were given a grant, I think it was $15,000. But we will be bringing workers to do something about their cases here in New York, at least just locally. At least just locally, which is a little upsetting because as we're speaking, just like half an hour ago, I also monitored another group on Facebook, which has more than 9,000 house cleaners. And one of the workers sent me a private message, and she said, "I really need to speak to someone. I need to, please reach out to me." I did right away. I gave her my phone number. Within a second, she called me. She was crying, hysterically crying. And I asked her, like, what happened? What's going on? I already kind of knew what she was going to say. And I kind of believe that she came, well, what she did is that she went online, one of these websites where she applied for a job. She went for an interview, and when the interview was ending, the employer started touching her. And then the only thing he says that he sent her a message saying that if she ever says something, he knew where to find her. And I'm like, why do workers have to go through this? All they want is a job. That's it. So it's kind of upsetting. Like, and it's sad because she's she's in another state. But I will do whatever I can to make sure that she gets the help she needs. It's hard, and we'll be hearing this. And I'm so glad that I was actually, I guess, she came forward because I posted something probably like 3 weeks ago on that group saying that I had been through that experience and that if they ever needed to talk, it was okay to talk about it, to not be ashamed. And actually, when I got her call, I got so glad I posted that message. And I'm glad we are part of the Time's Up movement and then Me Too, because workers are coming forward, and this is just the beginning.
So what kind of support are you and your organization working towards giving these women, and how are you what are you working to help them with? And what are some specific ways that these women can be supported so that they don't have to deal with this sort of sexual harassment and harassment in their workplace?
This is a topic nobody ever spoke about. And just recently, this whole movement has exploded. To be honest, we're still trying to figure it out. So far, we've opened what they call the, I'm bilingual, so I'm like, oh, in Baul. We open the book, what is it called? You open a Pandora, what is it called?
Pandora's box?
I'm sorry. and so we open up in like a chat, so that like people are, I don't know how to describe it, but I feel that it's taken, well, we just went to a recent hearing. We've gotten involved just recently in December. That was the first time we ever went to a hearing here in New York. They were talking about sexual harassment. Ever since then, it's been nonstop. And it's always just local here in New York City. And this case is happening somewhere in the Midwest. So I she will definitely get support. I told her, do not be afraid. Reach out to me. The National Domestic Workers Alliance will make sure you do get the support and help you need. I'd be like getting on the plane, running to her, like, that's me. That's my motherly.
It's really hard. I'm a mother as well, and it's really hard as a parent to explain this to your kids and get them involved and, you know, wanting to be so involved. So is this something that you've been sharing with your daughter? Have you brought her into your activism at all? Like, she did the performance with you, and did you explain to her the significance of what you were doing, and did she understand?
Yeah. It does. And I'm like, it's all sad, like, seeing my daughter cry this morning. And she understood the purpose behind, because there were two long, long 10-hour days, like, for rehearsal for a 3-minute show. But she understood. And after that, we had to do interviews. And she's like, why are we doing this? And she's been coming with me to actions, protesting. And when I explain her what's happening with the kids and the parents, the whole family separation, she's like, why are we going to another process? I'm like, remember about the story? What about the kids who are being separated? She's like, yes. If there's something I can do, Mommy, let me know. I will help you. I was like, okay, I love you. And she keeps asking my sister. And she's like, is there anything else we can do? Like, we already went to a march. We've done this. We've done that. We went on stage with Logic. Like, is there anything else we can do? I really want those kids to go back to their parents. And I'm like, we will make sure they do, baby. They will go back. And actually, after seeing the video, I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that impacted her.
Yeah.
And another thing, with the whole family separation, people, I'm saying this because a post I saw last night, too, I guess that was someone said that it was happening since the Obama administration. Yes, it was happening. But in this case, these parents were coming from South America, Central America, coming to the border and asking for asylum. When they got there, they got separated. That's a very different story than the parents there who were already here. It's totally different. All they were asking these parents was for protection and save their kids' lives, because they knew that if they would stay back in their country, they would be murdered.
Yes, you can definitely.
So that's all. Like, any parent will do anything for their kid. That's all they needed. And that's why, we are fighting against it, pretty much. You know, if you're asking for asylum, you shouldn't be separated from the kid. even for us, like, I'm sorry, you probably have to go, but even for us, as one of my colleagues said, when we were rehearsing for the show, there was a point where all parents were brought in on stage, behind stage, and the kids had to stay out either at the hotel or somewhere else. And just, like, being separated from your kid, not knowing where they were taking them, imagine that feeling. Like, it was maybe a few minutes. It wasn't, like, half an hour. No, it was just, like, a five-minute separation. And I'm like, where are I taking them? Are you making sure they're safe? Like, imagine those parents not knowing. I don't know if you heard the video, the audio. With the kid crying, like, I really need to talk to my aunt, like, and another one would have stopped crying. Imagine that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about the children's trauma, and that is absolutely, absolutely number one importance, the trauma inflicted on these children by these policies. But then you also have to think that the parents suffer trauma as well, and the psychological damage caused to everyone in this situation is just absolutely inhumane. So, yeah. Well, thank you, Daniela, for joining us. And thank you for doing all of the work that you do.
It will continue. We're not stopping. We're not stopping, actually. And actually, we're having another action on Tuesday, which I'll be part of it in New York, against cell family separation. We don't stop. We don't get a break. But it's all worth it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, thank you again. This was so fascinating. You do such amazing work. So have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, Devin, what are you grateful for this week?
So I am very grateful because on Saturday, I am going, this is so nerdy. Y'all, this is so nerdy. I'm going to the Labyrinth of Jareth Ball in downtown Los Angeles, which is the movie Labyrinth. If you've ever seen it, it is quite a ride to watch. But a whole bunch of people who love the movie and are huge nerds put together this huge ball at the Biltmore downtown, which is this like Art Deco building, beautiful. And it's a full on like Disney princess ball where people wear ball gowns, but then you also like dress up and it's a masquerade and you wear masks and headpieces. And like, I made myself a chainmail battle tiara and like scale mail armor to wear. It's fucking ridiculous. And my husband and I have been like prepping our outfits for it for months. We've been so excited about it. And so on Saturday, I'm going to go hang out with a whole bunch of other weirdos like myself and at this weird Labyrinth of Jareth ball in the middle of Los Angeles.
That's awesome.
I'm actually so excited about it. And I just love like having this group of friends that is so weird and so wonderful. And like, I can say like, hey, I made myself some scale mail armor. And they're like, oh yeah, I made myself some too. Like, let's compare notes instead of like, who the fuck makes scale mail armor in 2018 for fuck's sake. Oh, so that's what I'm really grateful for. It's a really great break. You know, so much going on. It's a really great break. So Varsha, what are you grateful for?
I am grateful for male overconfidence, oddly enough. So I'm not defending it here, but basically,
oh my God, this is my favorite. I almost want to use this as my gratitude check, Varsha, but because it's you, it's yours, obviously. But holy shit, I watched this play out last night. It was my favorite thing.
Yeah, so because I'm back in Berkeley, I downloaded a dating app again. And this one person, he was like, he asked me what I do. And I was like, oh, yeah, I study history. I'm doing a PhD in U.S. history. And he responds, oh, I love U.S. history. I know everything about U.S. history. And I'm like, oh, he's just joking. And he's just, you know, he's being funny. And I go, oh, wow, everything? Really? And then I think I was joking, too, because I thought he was being sarcastic. And then he responds, no, quiz me. Quiz me anything you're teaching this fall. And I was like, okay, can you explain to me, you know, why the Articles of Confederation were replaced with the new Constitution? And that's actually a difficult question. Like, in high school, you learn the answer about not being able to tax and all that stuff. But when you go to college and when you go to grad school, you learn, oh, there's actually like a difficult way to interpret these events. There's multiple reasons for this and stuff like that. But I was just looking for the simple answer, which is like money. And he responds like slavery. Wait, no, something about the Constitution was wrong. And I'm like, dude, you told me you knew everything. But you made me feel bad for like joking with you about it. And so the reason I'm grateful for male overconfidence is like throughout this conversation, I realized I'm actually pretty good at what I do. Like, I don't know everything about history, but I like what I do. I liked being able to like know an answer to something, but also that I, you know, I learned about this stuff last year and I still remember it. And I don't know, I was grateful for that. But also I tweeted out like this whole thread about it and everyone is responding, oh my God, this is me too. Like literally a bunch of women are like, yeah, this happens to me all the time. And they're PhDs in different fields. And I was like,
it is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
I have a PhD in nothing.
Yeah. And so that's why I'm grateful for this dude this week, at least, because like I feel more confident about myself. And so that's just really interesting. It's like, even though this was like toxic, probably, I was just like, eh, at least I proved you wrong. Right.
Also men are canceled.
Seriously. Yeah. But I found this as a learning experience about myself, and that's why I'm grateful for it.
All right, Varsha. So who is our Hellion of the week?
Okay. So I know I mentioned him on Monday, and I know he's a white dude. Yeah, it's Beto O'Rourke, because he had an amazing answer to a question. Somebody asked him, do you think it's disrespectful that football players are kneeling during the national anthem? And he basically said, you know, no, I don't think it's disrespectful. But he went through this long answer that very rarely do politicians use history correctly. I'm just going to say this. But he used
history. As a scholar of history, Varsha would know.
he used history pretty well to put the present in context, to illuminate that in the past, people who have been fighting for racial justice were called like were American heroes, but they were called traitors to the country and all this kind of stuff. And he's basically saying, no, it's you have integrity and decency if you are taking a knee, peacefully protesting to oppose police brutality. But you have to watch the video because it's just so powerful. And the reason I think he's a Hellion is because he doesn't give like a cookie cutter answer to the question. He doesn't give, you know, one type of answer is like, I would not do it, but I respect their First Amendment right to do it. Or he doesn't give a I would not do it answer. Or he doesn't give a simple free speech is important answer. He just goes deep into it. And he says, reasonable people can disagree on this, but here's what I'm saying. And he's just very open. He's very calm. He's very forceful with what he believes. And I think that's why it's the Hellion. And I think that's why he's the Hellion, is because he is just very clear that this is what he defines as American. And no one is less than these football players. No one is more than these football players. These football players are not less American. And I think that's just so inspiring.
Say, I really like that he didn't make it about free speech, because that's kind of the knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, right? That's true.
Oh, it's free speech, which it is. And that's definitely a good answer. But I think you're right, Varsha, in that he gave a very thorough, thoughtful answer that put this in a larger context of social justice and civil disobedience. And
he didn't parrot back the line that they're protesting the national anthem or they're protesting the flag, because that is not what they are doing. They are bringing attention. He said this as the whole country is watching these games, they're bringing attention to police brutality and the killing of unarmed black men and unarmed black kids and teenagers. And so I think that was also really important here, is that not only did he put it in historical context, he actually said what the real thing was about. And he also, and I know this is like difficult, like at least for me, it would be difficult, but he didn't condescend to the guy who was frustrated with this. Because I think the person who asked the question, you know, agreed that they shouldn't be protesting. And so he wasn't condescending to him. And like, that would have been hard for me to do. I might've been condescending. I might've been disrespectful. And so
I definitely would have been condescending, which is why I should never run for office.
Yeah. Right. Like, I would be very condescending to that person. And so he was very good at clearly and passionately explaining why racial justice is important in this country and why this type of protest is not disrespectful. And he didn't parrot back the line that's disrespectful to veterans and stuff like that. So I think he's the hellion. I also think he's doing amazing things in Texas. He's running a real grassroots campaign. Like, his ad is basically a patchwork of video from his like iPhone of him traveling across Texas. And so, like, I know that he's a white man. And I know that, like, this is the year of the woman. I know this is the year of, like, women of color running for office. I just think this answer was very clear this week. And this answer is just what we need in the midst of our president being a racist scumbag. Okay, Devin, what are some action items people can do after listening to the show?
Okay, so two main ones for this week. We are going to keep talking about Kavanaugh. And this week, we have some, I don't know if exciting is the right word, but Alexandra Lehman tweeted the other day, quote, "Senator Mazie Hirono just told us she will cancel her meeting with Kavanaugh as a result of yesterday's developments," which is Manafort and Cohen. She says, she will not extend the courtesy of interviewing a judge for a lifetime appointment to a president who is an unindicted co-conspirator. So basically, look, it doesn't look good for the president. And, you know, maybe he'll be impeached. Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll be indicted. Maybe he won't. Doesn't really matter for this conversation. This conversation is about Kavanaugh. And we need to let our members of Congress know and let our senators know that it is unacceptable to meet with a judicial nominee from a guy in an election year who is under investigation by the FBI. It's bullshit. We can't. That is not okay.
Yeah. And also, you should call your senators to tell them to vote no. Like, not just not meet with Kavanaugh, but vote no, because Kavanaugh himself thinks, like, has rethought the idea that a president can be subpoenaed, which is bananas. He his views on presidents being questioned and special counsels have changed with the party of the presidency. So under Clinton, he was happy to work for Ken Starr and be like, hey, yeah, Ken Starr, no, Bill Clinton should not be in office anymore because he had an affair and lied about it. And let's ask him really graphic questions publicly. But then when Bush is president, he's like, no, nobody can ask the guy about the Iraq War. No one can ask about torture. What are you talking about? Right? And so obviously this guy's going to be a fucking partisan hack. So that's why you should vote no on him. And also he's going to gut your reproductive rights, your civil rights, your voting rights, your health care.
It's a smorgasbord of options of why this guy
sucks. So you can choose. You can pick and choose. This is like a buffet. Pick and choose what you dislike about the guy. Call your senator, because he's not going to be a good judge. And, you know, the most amazing thing right now at the moment is that Mazie Hirono is like, hey, yeah, Donald Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator. So it's given Democrats a new avenue of attack, which I think is amazing.
Also, Mazie Hirono is amazing.
She should run everything.
And then second, I want to talk about the organization that Daniela is with from the interview, the National Domestic Workers Alliance. They are a fantastic organization that do work for domestic workers in this country. And you should definitely donate to their cause and support them. If you go to domesticworkers.org, they've got tons of information about how to take action, how to give, what they do, and the programs that they're running to keep people in domestic jobs and women specifically safe in their own situations. Like we talked about in the interview, a lot of these women are very isolated. You know, when you work in someone's home, there's no HR department. There's not even usually someone else to go to. You're working with one or two other people who are your employers. So it can be very scary and can be very traumatizing when something goes wrong. So they do a lot of really good work there, and they are definitely a cause worth giving to. Varsha, that's it for us.
Yeah, it's been an eventful week. Also, remember to subscribe to our newsletter because it is released every Friday morning. And remember to listen and subscribe to our Patreon. If you donate $5 a month, you get access to mini episodes. And we just did an episode about NATO. So remember to listen and subscribe.
Thank you, Hellion, so much for listening. Varsha and I will be back here on Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend and remember to raise some hell. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.